So this is an experiment. Let's see what happens here. You'll tell me at the end whether it worked out or not. So we want to figure out how we can make use of this unique and wonderful Zen literature. These stories are sometimes seem baffling, and when they were first introduced into Western culture, they were introduced with the idea that they're meant to be baffling and defeat your rational mind. So that automatically made everybody scared of them, as if if you really would seriously meditate on them, you would go crazy or something. You would lose your mind. And it almost made it sound like that was the idea, that you should lose your mind. But these stories are just Zen, which is to say Chinese Buddhist scriptures. They're just the stories of that are the scriptures of the Chinese, indigenous Chinese Buddhist tradition. Because Chinese people, very early on, learned about Buddhism, maybe in the first century, or even before the first century, they learned about Buddhism from India, and it was very, very foreign to them. Very foreign to them. And furthermore, the language in which the scriptures came was baffling to them, because Chinese language is a very different kind of language from Indo-European languages, Sanskrit, Pali. And Chinese culture is very different. So they had a really hard time understanding Buddhism and appreciating it. And of course, they made various efforts to translate the texts over time. But there was a natural need, because after all, China was in the year 100, was already the oldest civilization in the world and highly, highly developed with its own religion and philosophy and so on and so on. So there was a need for the Chinese people to make Buddhism their own and translate it into their own idiom. So the scriptures that they wrote Zen was, in effect, Chinese Buddhism. Zen didn't think of itself as being a school of Buddhism. It thought of itself as being simply Chinese Buddhism. So Zen stories are really just the scriptures of Chinese Buddhism. And in a way, it was a reaction to the literature that they were translating, which was expository, philosophically complex, not very poetic. Chinese culture has a very powerful poetic urge. It's built into the language, which is not an inflected language. So almost everything in Chinese language is implied, like in a poem. You know, things are not said, they're implied in the nature of the language. You don't have subject, object, verb. You have words that could be subject, object, or verb, and you can only tell by the context. So the Chinese needed a scripture that came from their own sense of the world. So they basically translated Buddhism into these little stories. And the stories are not lengthy disquisitions. They're very pithy, they're very short, they have a lot of humor in them. And it's quite telling that the stories are usually about interactions. You know, in other words, the Zen scripture is not somebody giving a long Dharma talk. It's people interacting over the teaching. Because there was a tremendous value in Chinese culture for community and connection and dialogue and conversation rather than disquisition. So these stories developed, and they developed out of the life of the monastics living together in community and grappling with the teachings, trying to understand the teachings, and their dialogues about the teachings became written down, usually around a particular master and the stories of his encounters with his teachers when he was a student and with his students when he was older. It was mostly was men. This became the scriptures, and then people later on began to pull out of this large collection of various records of various masters, they began to pull out their favorite stories and put them in collections of stories of various masters. And these got handed down through the generations, and it's a literature that we still have today, and that's now been translated into English. Not the vast literature of the many, many records of the many, many masters, which still exists in Chinese, but the few collections of choice stories that were used through the centuries have been translated into English. So this literature, this scriptural literature, was used in different ways at different times by different groups. But it is the scripture of Zen, so this is mostly the subject matter of Zen, classical Zen lectures would be on these scriptures, as well as on the whole of Buddhism, because, again, Chinese Buddhists did not think that they were doing some new thing called Zen. They thought they were just doing Buddhism. So they would talk about the Zen stories, but they would also talk about other things in earlier Buddhism, because all of Buddhism they considered to be their tradition. Well, at some point in probably the Song Dynasty, which is the medieval period around our calendar, around maybe the 12th century, 11th century, some teachers began devising different methodologies for working with these stories. They began to create curricula. You know, they would say, okay, now if you want to pass the course here, these are the stories that we're going to study in this order, and you have to show that you understand them in the way that I approve of, you know, and so on. So they have devised various curricula and then various methodologies. And since the literature, the Chinese really, then this was completely comes out of their Chinese culture, they believed that an intellectual understanding of the teachings was insufficient for transformation. Something that I think we would also agree with. That one had to have an intuitive sense of what the Buddha taught and what was being said in these stories. So that it wasn't enough to be able to recite the story and give a philosophical explanation of it. You had to somehow demonstrate that you had really understood the story for yourself. You made it personal. That you understood it from the inside of your own life. So they began to devise various ways of how you could show that, how you could demonstrate that. And these ways became codified. Like everything in religion, it gets codified and boring, you know. Give it a couple of generations and, you know, it gets codified and boring. And that also happened here. So probably anybody who's read any books about Zen is aware of the methodology that was developed mostly in Japan many centuries later. Japanese took the Chinese method and elaborated it. And so you've read stories about somebody meditating on their koan, meditating on the story, taking it to the cushion, sitting in intense meditation, trying to, you know, come to an understanding, an intuitive flash of understanding of the story, going into the Zen master to present that understanding pretty much before they even have a chance to open their mouth. The Zen master rings a little bell, kicks them out, and the next person comes in. There's an endless stream of people coming in. And then eventually, you know, somebody, aha, they do, you know, they do really have an intuitive understanding of the story. The Zen master says, you know, that's good. Now here's the next story. Go back. So this is a methodology that does exist up until the present day and is still being practiced in some places. But you can see from a contemporary perspective that there are problems with this whole thing, right? On the one hand, I've practiced in this form, and it's very fun, frustrating in many ways, difficult, but very fun. You appreciate the system and how it works. But there are many problems. For one thing, at some point, your practice becomes a kind of an endless treadmill of going through 700 stories, which takes years, decades, right? And you forget about everything else. All you're concerned about is, because now at some point you have a lot invested in this, right? And you want to get to the end. And then you have your friend who's ahead of you you're only on a story number 90 and she's on story number 210. And so then everybody says, she's on 210, I never liked her anyway. And all this, you know. So this happens. Plus, you're probably not a monastic living in a monastery. You're probably, you know, a regular person. You probably have a family and a job and everything. And at some point, you have to ask yourself, why am I doing this? How is this helping my life? You know, this becoming an expert on this archaic, strange Zen methodology. Why am I really doing this? Plus, how could it be true, as it is in this methodology, how could it be true that this and only this is the proper response to the story? And if I don't say this and only this or do this and only this in this way, I don't pass the story. How can that be true? And it is true in that system. And the teacher who's passing you or failing you on the story all by himself or herself without any consultation with anybody else is completely in control of the whole thing. So you can imagine, this is a problem too, right? So this has been noticed by people. A generation ago, only one generation ago, the system was handed down pretty much as received from the Japanese teachers who gave it. But by this generation, the generation that I'm in, many, many teachers who are in that system are experimenting in different ways. However, that which we understand to be the way the practice works is actually not, that whole thing that I just said is not the way the practice works. That's one way the practice works. And in fact, in our tradition, we never did it that way. Soto Zen, our tradition in Japan, never did it that way. Our tradition follows the great Zen teacher Dogen, who lived in the 13th century. And his way of working with the stories was simply to talk about them, give talks in intense monastic environments. And then he would often say, at certain points in his talk, he would say, investigate this. You don't necessarily notice that when you're reading along. You know, you hear him say, investigate this, investigate this. But you can imagine that what he meant was, investigate this, spend time in your meditation, in your reflections, really, really understanding personally, and the word personal is very important here in all these systems, understand personally what this teaching is about. And making the teaching personal is a very big part of Zen practice. It's not enough to understand it in the abstract or even understand it in some spiritual way. You have to understand it spiritually, but also personally. How does this teaching show up for you as an individual in the life that you're leading, your unique circumstances? So Dogen would say, you know, investigate this, and presumably the monastics would investigate it, and they would, in our tradition, one-on-one interview is a very important practice. So people would come to Dogen, I'm sure, and they would give their understanding of the story, and he would relate to them about that understanding. So I appreciate these stories a lot. I think the idea of a spiritual practice that really is personal, that really is intuitive and poetic, I think is of great value. Also, one that has a certain sense of humor, a sense of ease about it, is very valuable. So I'm thinking to myself, how are we going to really make use of these stories? I don't think the usual ways are going to work for us. Sorry. So I've been experimenting in different ways. I would like to be able to, before I'm done here, I would like to be able to think that we could come up with our own collection from the in other words, classically there are probably 1,500 important stories, maybe more. And the different systems have different curricula, but there are at least 600-700 stories. Well, we don't really need that many. Who has time for 600 or 700 stories? We're too busy. Besides that, there's really, honestly, a lot of repetition. So I think we need 50 stories or 60 stories, maybe. And I think we need a methodology that we can really use to be able to really make these stories personal for us and illuminating for our lives. So, and I don't think we can just sort of like blithely do this. I think we have to think about it for 50 or 60 years. And I've been thinking about it for 25 anyway. So I'm hoping that before I'm done, you know, I could maybe make a contribution by making a selection and making these experiments and seeing how they work. And if they do work, any of them, then we can say, okay, here's a way of doing it. So thank you for, without realizing you're doing it, agreeing to be guinea pigs in the service of Zen. Thanks. Hopefully it will be fun and of some benefit. So I've just described the usual methodology. So here's my methodology. Here's the experiment. This is we're going to do this process. And we'll do it, maybe we'll do it four times. Maybe we'll do it in each segment, this morning, this afternoon, tomorrow morning, tomorrow afternoon. We'll see. If you hate it and you revolt, well, I guess we won't do it. But we'll see. So here's what we'll do. Step one. I will simply read you the story. The stories, the English translations, there are three important collections of Zen stories, all three of which have been translated into English. All three of which consist of the story itself, which is quite brief, sometimes one line, the story itself, often an introduction to the story, a poem about the story, and a lengthy commentary on both the story and the poem. Well, I'm not going to burden you with all of that. I'm just going to read you the story. And I may read some of the rest of that material, just a few sentences if I think it's worthwhile. But when you think about it, why would a medieval Chinese commentary written for a medieval Chinese monastic audience necessarily be of relevance to us, right? And I find that mostly it's not. We need our own commentaries, right? So I'll read you the story. And whatever few words of commentary I think would be of use. And then, right after that, step two, we'll sit and contemplate the story in meditation for maybe 10 minutes. We could do it longer. You could do it for years, but let's just do it for 10 minutes. And the way we'll do that is, I will, while we're sitting, I will speak for you phrases, key phrases from the story for you to meditate on. And the way you do it is you would establish your breath and your posture and your concentration, like we always do in meditation. And as if you could imagine, you're creating with your attention and your posture and your breathing, you're creating a pond, you know, with a still surface. And in that still surface, we're going to drop a phrase, plop, and then it has ripples. So you'll sit and you'll, with your breath, with your exhale, you'll just repeat the phrase to yourself until the next one comes along. Repeat that phrase to yourself. And while you're repeating it, you're trying to concentrate on the phrase with your breath. You're not trying to think about it. We're so used to, you know, in our whole education system is think about this and come up with some clever ideas about it. Not that. Breathing with it in your body. And noticing what arises in the heart or mind in response. Just noticing what comes up. But then coming back to the phrase. Is that clear how we do that? So we'll sit for 10, maybe 15 minutes. Just sitting with the story, so that we're not thinking about the story or figuring it out, but really internalizing it in the breath and in the body. After we do that, the third part will be, I will give a brief commentary of my own on the case, a commentary that hopefully will be of relevance to our world and our life. Maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes. That's step three. There are five steps. That's step three. The fourth step is that we'll take a little time to contemplate the story further. And that means that we'll just take maybe 15 minutes or so. I don't know how the timing is going to work, but about 15 minutes. And during that time, you can contemplate the story in whatever way you want. If you want to, you can journal about it, if you have your journal with you. If you want to, you can sit some more with whatever one of the phrases seemed most apt for you. You can sit some more. Or you can walk and walk with the phrase. Or you can just go outside and sit and look at the sky or whatever you want to do. You can make a cup of tea. But the whole time, stay with the phrase. That's the idea. Because in this practice of contemplating a story, the idea is you contemplate it 24/7, not only when you're sitting, but you stay with it. So we can experiment with staying with the story even as we're moving around or doing other things. That's step four. And then we'll come together. And step five is a very, very important part, is you have to express yourself. These stories are meant to be, you must express your understanding of the story. So what we'll do is we'll sit in a group with other people, maybe one other person, maybe two other people, and then we'll just give each person so many minutes to say whatever it is that they're feeling about this story, this process, whatever it is, however it comes to you, to say something. It's very important that you open up your mouth and say something, right? Because spiritual practice is not passive. You have no choice. Your understanding might be all cockeyed and so on. It makes no difference. You must express yourself. So everybody will get to express themselves. And that's the fifth part. So again, obviously, we're not talking here about correct answers. We're talking about your own process. And the question is this worth doing? Do we get anything out of this? Do we learn something? Does it influence our lives? Does it influence the way we understand ourselves? And we'll find out the answer at the end, whether it does or not. So that's the experiment. Everybody willing to see what happens here? Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. I recognize that it would be hard for somebody to stand up and say, no, I didn't sign up for that, I'm not going to do that. And I think nobody else here wants to do it either. I realize it would be hard to do that. So it's a little unfair the way I'm asking you the question. On the other hand, it would not be impossible to do that. So I'm giving you three breaths to do that if you want to. Okay, this is the 21st story in the Book of Serenity, a collection of 100 Zen stories. This is the 21st story. The title of the story is Yunyan Sweeps the Ground. As Yunyan was sweeping the ground, Da Wu said, too busy, too busy. Yunyan said, you should know there's one who's not busy. You should know there's one who's not busy. Da Wu said, if so, then there's a second moon. Yunyan held up his broom and said, which moon is this? Which moon is this? Here's a word from Wansong's commentary. Good people, as you eat, boil tea, sow and sweep, you should recognize the one not busy. Then you will realize the union of mundane reality and enlightened reality. Then you will realize the union of mundane reality and enlightened reality. And we call this simultaneous inclusion. So let's sit with this story for a few minutes. Too busy, too busy. Can you find the one who's not busy? And are there two moons? Two realities? which moon is this? Right now. Which moon is this? Maybe you can relate to this phrase, too busy. We're all so busy. And it's great, we have so many possibilities. One thing leads to another, you can, you know, go on Google and before you know it, you don't know where you are. One thing leads to another, one contact leads to another, one activity leads to another, and before you know it, you're rushing around in all directions at once. There's so much to take care of. And the more we appreciate our lives and the more we know about our lives, the more there is to take care of. Someone some years ago gave us a house. We never had a house. Someone gave us a house, and now we have many problems. Our many blessings become our curses, right? Maybe ignorance really is bliss. We didn't used to know, for example, how important it is to exercise. So we didn't have the problem of how we're going to exercise every day. It didn't bother us, you know. Now, we have to either exercise or feel guilty that we're not doing it or driven to do it when we're not doing it. It's a burden. It's a blessing that we know this and that we're healthier, but it's also a burden. We used to think that, you know, you could just take all your human relationships completely for granted. We didn't know that we have to, you know, look after one another and consider each other's feelings and communicate with each other and be concerned for one another, all of which takes time. You want to rectify all your human relationships, you better quit your job, because it would take that much time to be straight and clear with everybody in your life. So the more we know about our human relationships, the more complicated and they can be. And we all have parents and children and friends and colleagues and lovers to relate to. We have careers, we have ambitions. And we have our spiritual lives. That takes a lot of time. You know, to show up to Sims all the time, that's really quite an obligation put on our calendar. We're very busy. How are we going to do all these things? Well, it's pretty much impossible. And we all know it. So this is Yunyan sweeping the ground. He's taking care of things. And he's doing it earnestly. He's working hard. Dawu, who actually was his close friend and Dharma brother, and I think they were actually brothers biologically too, he questions Yunyan's activity. It's good, you know, we all would like to have a close Dharma brother or sister who would question our activity, cause us to question our own activity. If we don't have someone like that, we should do it ourselves. What am I really doing? What am I really doing here? Am I just rolling along without knowing what I'm doing, or do I know what I'm doing? We need to ask ourselves this question pretty much every day. Having been wound up, are we just winding down? Are we going on with something that at one time made sense and doesn't anymore? We all need to take a look. So Dawu was doing that for Yunyan. Too busy. But Yunyan actually does know what he's doing. You should know there's one who's not busy. That is, in the midst of our activity, no matter how intense it may seem to be, there is stillness, there is balance. And the only question is, can we be in touch with it? Can we find it? Are we aware of it? The truth is, we're always doing one thing. Just one thing. There's no multitasking. There's no having a million things going on. There's only ever one thing in this moment. And this is so characteristic of Zen, as the little commentary says, mundane activity and transcendent spiritual unity is one thing in this moment. Chop wood, carry water. You know, that's the famous saying of Layman Pong, is Zen practice. Before my wife and I had twin sons many, many years ago, before that, I had been living a very simple life. I always prided myself on the fact that I could move my entire belongings in the trunk of my car. It was wonderful. I loved living that way. And I actually, to be honest with you, didn't really plan on having twins so rapidly. It was a little bit not the plan. Don't tell them I said so. Actually, they know this very well. So, but then I thought, oh no, there goes my simple life. How could you have a simple life if you have twins? And look at all this stuff. You know, you want to get in the car. You know, you got all this stuff you need. But then I realized one day, actually, it's no different. I'm always just putting one suitcase in the car, right? And one suitcase in the car. And one suitcase in the car. It's really not any different. I'm just doing one thing. Life really is as simple or as complicated as we make it. Every moment contains its own solution. Because every moment really is complete. It comes up full, it passes away full, and everything is complete. No matter how complicated things seem to be. The complications come from our own conceptualization. They don't come from the fabric of reality itself. Nothing really is complicated. There's only just sweeping the ground right now. There's no such thing as being busy. There's no such thing as being too busy. There's no such thing as time pressure. There's no such thing as short on time. There's no such thing as running out of time. These are concepts that we're addicted to, but they're not fixed realities. So watch your mind. Watch how your mind will make things complicated. Watch how you can be swept up into a busy world. Most people, when you say, "How are you doing?" they say, "Oh, I'm so busy." I try never to say that. Why would I want to create a busy world for myself, which I find unpleasant? I'm not busy, unless I want to give myself that problem. But we like being busy because important people are busy. People who are not very important are not busy. You don't want to say, I've got not much going on. Because then, you know, you're not really too significant. So you like being busy. But, let's be honest, it's really a big burden. What if you could actually, in the middle of your harried day, train your mind to take one breath and say to yourself with full conviction, there's one right here who's not busy, right now. And just let go of the busyness and simply do what you're doing. On each occasion, how do you find that person? How do you return to your roots? Dawu says, "Oh, so then there are two moons? Which moon is this?" As you know, especially in Chinese Buddhism, the idea of the metaphor of the moon is used a lot. My favorite example in the sutra is there's a sutra called the Sharingama Sutra, where somebody looks at the moon and presses their finger on an eyeball, and they open up their eyes and they see two moons. Which an experiment which you can try yourself, and it actually happens. You see two moons. And then the question is, which moon is the real moon? And the answer is, neither one. Both moons are ultimately illusory. Let go. Everything is already enough. Everything is already finished. So this is a pretty useful practice, a pretty useful contemplation. Can you get in touch with the one who's not busy? Can you make friends with her to such an extent that she's never far away? And that here and now, right now, at any time, whether you're chopping wood, carrying water, meditating, talking on the phone, or online, why can't the whole of awakening be present in that moment? Is there any reason why? Or is awakening anywhere else in that moment but there? And could you know that? So that's my little talk, and let's take 15 minutes or so. Now, just a little bit further instructions here. The idea is to spend the next 15 minutes or so paying close attention to whatever you're doing, to your body as you move, to your hands as you're pouring tea, and then be aware, grounded in the body, and in your activity, and in your senses. Be aware of whatever is arising and passing away in your mind. So the idea here is not to think about this and reflect on it in the way you would usually reflect. The idea is to be attentive to what might come up from a deeper place in your mind. Now, if you do reflect on it and have the usual kinds of thoughts, this, I'm not saying, oh, you're a bad person, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. No, that probably will happen too. But just know that churning that is not what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is notice that, come back to the body, and see if anything else comes up. And it may not. It's not like, you know, something is supposed to come up. No, no, but you're just clearing the space. So it's almost like you could say that what we're doing here, and this is certainly true in the technique of contemplating the stories, what we're doing here is we're trying to develop another kind of thinking. The usual kind of thinking that we have is based on problem solving and self-interest. That's why does thought proceed from one thing to another in the way that it does? What's the engine that drives it? It's self-interest and the desire to solve a problem. But that's just one way of thinking. Poets don't think like that. Religious sages don't think like that. They think in the body. They think with the heart. So that's the idea, to use your body and awareness of the body and your loving curiosity about your own mind and your own process to see what happens.